That's possible, but there are a lot of alternate explanations. Maybe he wanted Esau to actually carry out a task before the blessing. Maybe it was important to him that Esau do something to show his love for him before he gave him the blessing, right? Or maybe he wanted Esau to do what he knew Esau loved. He wanted him to go out and hunt because that's what Esau loved to do.
So
that we've discussed a lot. That I don't know, and it's an issue, but the question of, is there another reason why he would have sent Esau out? Yeah, there is. Whether he could be fooled or not, let me put it this way. The pshat of the Bible, which is the simple meaning, and we're going to look at a couple of commentaries about the question of the firstborn, but we should all realize when we go into all these interpretations about whether he was really fooled or he wasn't fooled, if you just read the story, he clearly was fooled. Right? Clearly he was fooled. When Esau comes in and gets and starts screaming, it seems as though there was a deception that went on. And not only that, but if he wasn't fooled, then why does Rebecca have to go through the whole business? Why doesn't she just say to Isaac, okay, it's time now to bless Jacob? Now, when we say he couldn't possibly have been fooled, I just want us to know that we may be right, but we're going a level deeper than the simple story. And we should at least keep our eyes on the fact that the way the text simply reads, he was fooled. Now, you can make a good case that he wouldn't have been fooled, that really, I mean, the deception is pretty crude, right? She puts stuff on his, I don't know that you could put something on the back of someone's neck that would really feel like human hair very well. But let's keep this problem. In a moment, we'll get to Rebecca's answer to this, so to speak. Remember that last time, or a couple times ago, I brought in this book by Ellen Frankel that is a woman's commentary on the Bible, so I thought I would bring us up to date with the woman's commentary. And remember that she writes it in different voices, right? One is the voice of Rebecca, one is the voice of Lilith, who is sort of the rebel. And so as we go through this, I'll tell you what, one is Hagar, who is the stranger. Hagar gets upset that Esav, remember, Esav marries two women who upset his parents. So this is something that Hagar knows, right? And his third wife is the daughter of Yishmael. So here Hagar says in this book, right through Ellen Frankel, Hagar says, you see, he was trying to please his parents. And when he married women that didn't please his parents, he made sure to go back and marry a third woman that would please his parents. So Lilith adds, the deck was stacked against him from the beginning, right? And then it says, our bubbies, that is our grandparents, they're the voice of like the standard tradition, says, the Torah's silence about this match should speak for itself. which does exactly sound like what a grandmother would say. Our daughters ask, so here's the second question they ask. Why does Rebecca listen in to the conversation with Esau? Right? We all agree that she was eavesdropping. Why? So here's wily Rebecca. Wily means clever, right? Rebecca answers, because I, like all women in my society, was marginalized, loitering at the edges, listening at the tent flap, stitching together scraps of overheard conversation, innuendo and hearsay to construct news. I was a spy in my own home. Just as Sarah heard indirectly the angel's prophecy that she'd give birth to a son, I learned of Isaac's plan to bless Esau only by listening in on their conversations. As it is written, Rebekah had been listening as Isaac spoke. I make no apologies for eavesdropping. I told Jacob plainly, I overheard your father speaking to your brother Esau. Right? So she feels as though if she wants to know what goes on in her own home, she has to listen at keyholes. Just think of it as if she has a teenage son or daughter, right? You have to listen in, you have to eavesdrop on their emails, otherwise you'll never know what's going on. And Lilith the rebel adds, those denied access to information are the most eager to acquire it and the most skilled at getting it, right? The people who don't, I mean, think again how your children eavesdrop on your conversations, right? The same thing, they're denied access to the information, so they become skilled at figuring out how to get it. Yes? Well, that's the next question. When did she plan it? We're going to come to that in a second. She, by the way, says, I paid dearly for my actions. Jacob was away in Padan Aram for 20 years. Remember, Jacob has to leave the house because Esau wants to kill him. And that's her punishment, in quotes, for having arranged this whole thing, as she loses her son for 20 years. And during this time, he and his four wives raised 12 sons and a daughter. I died before he returned, never having seen my grandchildren. And once again, what you hear is that if you look at this from a woman's point of view, it's a different story, right? If you hear Rebecca talk about it, then it's very different from if you hear, question, where is it? Oh, I missed the question that you just brought up, which is, when did Rebecca plan this? Where is it? Family patterns. There's one in here. Oh, and also whether has a nice one about whether Rebecca loves Esau. There's a very nice passage. But first, how spontaneous is Rebecca's wolf in sheep's clothing scheme? In other words, did she just overhear Isaac and say, ah, and immediately come up with a scheme? So this is how Ellen Frankel has Rebecca answer. Of course I'd been plotting. My eavesdropping was completely premeditated. I'd been waiting for my chance ever since I heard God's prophecy that Jacob and not Esau would inherit. As it is written, Rebecca had been listening. That is, this was a regular thing. I didn't simply overhear. I intentionally listened in. When I said to Jacob, now my son, listen carefully as I instruct you, I was offering him a plan I'd already cooked up. Because I knew Isaac favored Esau. I knew that food was the surest way to Isaac's heart. Unlike my father-in-law Abraham, who reacted impulsively when the angels appeared, I was deliberate. I'd chosen my recipes far in advance. So, yes.
Question, how does one teach this to children that are like in their middle school years?
That's not a quick question. Save it. Save it. Because I'll come back to it, but I just want to say this is a generic question for lots of the Torah stories that are morally problematic, right? So there are two basic approaches, and I'll come back to them in a second. Does Rebecca love Esau? I won't go through the whole answer, but do you remember what she says when she chases Jacob away? We haven't come to that yet. I don't think we read it. Do you remember what she says to him? She says, let me not lose you both in one day. So she does love Esau. But she realizes that in order to do what she needs to do, both for herself and for God, she has to lose him, which is a very painful realization, right? That she has to lose him. Here's a big stretch. I don't know how many of you watch The Wire. Have any of you ever watched that show on HBO? I think it's Shakespearean. It's brilliant. It's as brilliant as a brilliant novel. It's an amazing show, and it's in its last season. In fact, the last episode is this Sunday. But in the previous episode, there was the most heartbreaking set of scenes. There was a young guy who, to make a very, very long and complicated story short, he ends up killing another person in the gang. And he's someone who started out like a good, sweet kid and eventually became very hard because of his life on the streets. And towards the end of the episode, he does two things. First, he sends his younger brother off to an aunt. He's been taking care of his younger brother for years. He sends him off to an aunt because he knows that there's going to be revenge, and he can't, so he parts with his younger brother. He goes back into the car with his best friend, who's not really in the gang. His best friend doesn't fit. He's not hard. He's not mean. And his best friend says to him, do you remember that time when we did this and we did that and we did the other thing? And he looks at him and goes, no, I don't remember. And he, of course, does remember, but he knows that he has to separate himself emotionally from this kid, too, so this kid stays away from him, because otherwise he's going to get killed, too. And you see him isolate himself in order to do what he has to do because he knows he's going to be a target. And I'm expecting in the last show he probably will be. And that's what Rebecca did. She estranged her husband. She estranged her son. And she sends away Jacob, all because she knows she has to do this. Right? She knows she has to do it. But it's really, if you think about it from her point of view, it's really very painful. It's a tragedy to see her gradually isolate herself because she feels she has to do what's right for her children. And then lastly, she says, from the beginning of my marriage, and this is what actually your question at the beginning kicked off this whole, I was the one to make choices for my family. I was betrothed long distance, but I chose to leave home and come to Isaac. When I was told about God's plan, I tricked Isaac into blessing the chosen one. When I saw that Esau married foreign wives and was now bent on murder, I forced Isaac to send Jacob away and raise a proper heir to the covenant. And I knew how to win Isaac's heart so he would honor my choices. I understood that he couldn't see past himself and his own narrow concerns. That's why he wanted to bless Esau, because Isaac couldn't see the larger picture. Only Rebecca could. This is according again to Ellen Frankel's Rebecca, right? So I couched my action in a language he could understand. I earned his love by taking his dead mother's place, forced his blessing by satisfying his appetite for food, married Jacob off by appealing to his compassion for me. Never did I take the high ground and speak of God's design. I knew my customer far too well. It's very good, isn't it? So that's only, I understand that's only one way of looking at it, but I thought it was a very powerful and effective way. And what I would say about teaching it to children is it depends what lesson you want to get across. You can get across the lesson, I mean, this is a very good story to get across the lesson that parents actually sometimes choose things that are painful for their children and painful for their parents because they know in the end it's better, right? That's what she does. Yeah. Of right.
From Abraham. So then, why couldn't you come up with this idea that perhaps because they have two children, that bear fight is something kind of ridiculous, so that they can divide their money or their land between the two of them equally?
Well, this raises the question, first of all, of whether the birthright was about the land, and actually I have another section about that. That's the next thing I'm going to. But also, all of society was built on the birthright. One person couldn't just say, oh, let's forget the birthright. It would be like saying, for one person to say, oh, let's just forget about inheritance. The person who carried on the family name was the person who bore the family mission, and someone had to be chosen to do it. What happens if you have two people who both bear the family mission is that they end up fighting and neither one of them succeeds in doing it. It would be, it's just like, it's very difficult to put two brothers in charge of the same family business. One of them has to be the boss and one of them not, and that's very painful for the kids. But
that's why the legacy is something painful, so that
right.
Divide your children and therefore one decides to hate the other and
that's well, if that happens anyway. But that happens anyway. The actual, the best way,
if you, children equally, then they turn,
but what I'm saying is there are some things that can't be equally divided. You're assuming that everything in the world can be equally divided. It can't. For example, let's say I had two children. Let's say I had two sons, okay? And someone said to me, you know what? You should leave Sinai Temple to one of your sons, should be the rabbi of Sinai Temple. So I say to the two of them, listen, I want you both to be the rabbis of Sinai Temple. I have just ensured the failure of their careers and of the synagogue. Because two people can't be equal rabbis in the same place. If I said to one of them, you be the senior rabbi and you be the assistant, then they have a chance of working it out. Or if I say to them, you're the one who really should be a rabbi, you should find your own career. Then they have a chance of working it out. But if I try to make them equal, I have in fact made them both fail. So Jacob was suited to carry on this. Rebecca was right. Esau wasn't. That's why he founded his own people. He founded Edom. And in the end, remember, they come back and they reconcile.
But he found his own people because he was treated that way.
Exactly. That's exactly right. But you remember that they come back. But you remember they come back in the end and they reconcile. The question is, what would have happened to the two of them if they had both been given the mission of carrying on God's word? I don't know, but I doubt in the end they would have come back and reconciled and they both would have had a people. I think that the idea that you can always, it's a sort of, I mean, in some ways it's an American prejudice that you know, when you say all people are created equal, it means to start with, right? But people are given very different endowments, very different abilities, and if you try to fit them into the same role just because they're both born to you, I think that in the end you might end up causing more damage than help. And if Esau had said, if Isaac had said, both of you carry on God's word, I don't think it would have worked. I think Rebecca was right, but, yeah.
Michael makes a big point out of establishing who came first. They tie a ribbon
right.
to the toe.
Yes.
So the question is now not what the marriage should be done, but what was the custom at the
time? Well, but what she was saying is why didn't Rebecca upend the custom? And I'm saying that actually the custom is based on a truth of human nature that I think endures, which is, and this, by the way, I mean, this is not just a biblical issue. I mean, every person that I know of who has some kind of business or legacy to leave children struggles with this. And the answer is never so easy as just divided equally among them, because, how many businesses do you know that have this struggle and fight? It's a hard decision. Yeah.
The sons of Aaron.
What's that?
The heredity of Aaron and
his. Right. They're priests, but only one is the high priest. So you can say you can all work in the business, but only one of you get to be the high priest, right? There's one high priest at a time. And there's a good example, actually. You can't make both kids the high priest. High priests. Yes.
Touched by the light she or you shed on Rebecca as someone who had to give up her own self-interest and herself, really, to be there for a nation, for a community. And I was going to ask you, was a man put in the same position? And I thought of Abraham, but in
many were. Moses gave up everything. Continually, over and over and over again, and he didn't want to do it. God forced him to do it. If you go into the service of God in the Bible, you end up giving up a lot.
But he was dissatisfied from the beginning. He didn't feel part of the Egyptian empire.
We don't know. He was very happy in Midian, though. He was happy in Midian, and he didn't want to go be the. He says to God, Shlach na biyad tishlach, send anyone else you want, just not me. But God forces him to do it. Look, I know you want me to say only women give up, but it's not true. It's just not true. Moses gave up everything.
But I think it was character building with Moses, whereas Rebecca.
I think this is a little bit of special pleading. He didn't get his kids to follow him. He was continually rebelled against. What he got out of it was a close relationship with God. But I assume Rebecca did too, right?
Yeah, I'm not trying to make it gender specific. Actually, okay. I was trying to disperse it because on one hand she says, well, women had a minor role and they had to manipulate and such. And on the other hand, I see the other side of the coin that she actually annihilated herself.
There are clearly differences in male and female roles, but the trait of self-sacrifice is not gender specific. So, yeah.
This brings us to the conclusion that even though God wants something and makes it clear that God thought that not Esau, but Jacob was the chosen one, so to speak, but we still need the interference of people.
Right. Yes. Yep. Over and over again. That's true. That human beings make the decisive difference. God speaks the language of human beings. Let me just move a little bit forward here. We can talk much more about the story when we get the whole picture, but realize that for most of these questions, this is a funhouse mirror, right? You can see it in lots and lots of different directions, but I want to talk more about the birthright also, because there is a disagreement about the birthright and what it means. Whether the birthright means financial stuff, or whether, in fact, it means, or whether it just means carrying on the job of bringing God's word into the world. So Ibn Ezra and Rambam, two commentators, disagree about this. Ibn Ezra says that the Bechora, the firstborn, is about money too. And when you ask the question, he asks two questions. One is your question, if it's money, why doesn't he just divide the money? And second, if it's really that much money, why does Esav say, I'll sell it all for lentils? I mean, because if it was really a lot of money, he would at least say, I'll give you 10% for the lentils. And Ibn Ezra's assumption is that Yaakov was poor. He says Ibn Ezra explains that although Avram was a wealthy man, Yitzchak fell on hard times. Esav was selling one-third of Yitzchak's estate, and he considered Yaakov's pot of lentils more valuable than a few extra pennies he might one day inherit. We've assumed that Yitzchak was wealthy, but Ibn Ezra doesn't assume that. He assumes that Avram was wealthy, but Yitzchak didn't keep up the family business very well. And he proves this contention from another incident in Toldot, where Isaac sends Esav to prepare a meal before giving him a blessing, for the same reason that Esav himself was interested in Yaakov's lentils. In his current financial state, a proper meal was hard to come by. That's why I said later on I'm going to deal with the finances. According to Ibn Ezra, the reason he sends Esav out is because they don't have a lot of food. Maybe Rachel was hiding a kid in the back for the eventuality of, but you know, she was the household manager. But so the firstborn, it didn't mean that much money, and he wanted Esav to hunt because he didn't have that much. Ramban, Nachmanides, disagrees. He says that it was about the position of authority. That's what the Bechora is about. But it could be either one, and it's not clear there's another issue there too, but I don't want to go into it. Then there's more discussion about what the Bechora meant and if it meant something different after the Torah was given. Right? Ramban Nachmanides thinks that actually the character of the firstborn son and what it means changed after the Torah was given, but we don't have to go into that right now. Yeah. I can't hear you. I don't know why it was. According to Ibn Ezra, it wasn't. It was because he had spiritual stature, but we read it as money. Yeah. Right.
That's Isaac.
Right, but that was before, right?
You acquired flocks and
herds. What? Right, which verse are you quoting from, though?
26:12.
Right, and when does he, many years later, right? He either gives or doesn't give the blessing. So, I don't know. We read it as his being wealthy. Ibn Ezra reads it as his having become poor. Yeah.
The way to do it isn't to say directly, listen, son, you blew it. You're not getting the main blessing. But to be a little bit
deceptive. I don't know, you know.
To not be offensive to Esav.
If she was trying not to be offensive to Esav, it didn't work, right? If that was her lesson. I'm of two minds about this, and to quote a great sage, Paul Simon, of Simon and Garfunkel, I think that he put it best in terms of the way people in his song when he says, "You don't have to lie to me, just give me some tenderness beneath your honesty," which means that you shouldn't trick him, you should be honest with him, but just be tender in your honesty. However, I certainly know, and I'm sure all of you do too, there are some things that you have to say to people that no matter how you say it, it's going to be hurtful. It just is. And you try to cushion it as much as you can, and it's still hurtful. And you just have to take the consequences of that. So I think the reason that Rebecca didn't do it is that she knew that Isaac could block her scheme. And if she made it too obvious too soon, then in the end, Jacob might not get the blessing, and that would be a tragedy for God's design. Yeah. I can't hear.
I don't mean this to sound crazy to you, or to any of the other husbands or men here, but there's sort of a reality to
right.
Rebecca being a little bit of a web spinner.
Right.
I mean, she's a woman, and she's a woman in a man's world, and I think that, you know, if there's a lesson to teach our middle schoolers, or at least our girls, is that this is part of who you are allowed to be in a relationship.
I actually talked about this in a previous class, probably in your absence. where I said that that's, I mean, How many times, I don't remember exactly the example I used, but how many times have women noticed in the course of an average week that, yes, he left his pants on the floor in front of the bed again. So what am I going to do? I'm not going to say to him again, please pick your pants up. I'm going to wait till he walks into the room and I will pick them up, which will give him the message without my having to say to him, please pick up your pants, or something like that. In other words, you try to get a message across in ways that are not direct, because you know that direct ways have limited effectiveness and sometimes are more offensive. So that's just the reality of male-female relations. Yes?
I have two questions. God can do whatever he wants. Why didn't he just have Jacob be born first?
You can ask. Well, wait. You can ask that, but you can ask that about any problem that exists in life or in the Bible. And it seems clear that God wants human beings to seek solutions in this world in their own way. Right.
There's a lot of important things in Torah that are not even mentioned.
Yes.
And a lot of things that are mentioned in extreme detail. Why is there such a detail and emphasis in this story in the Bible? I mean, there's many.
This is why. This is why. Because it's so rich and teaches us so much. That's what I assume, right? I mean, we're spending a lot of time on the story and we still have quite a ways to go. Because the truth is that even though, and this is why Genesis is such a fascinating book, because even though when people think about Torah, they think about great principles of life, you spend most of your life with your family, with your siblings, with small things where how you live is illustrated, right? Most people don't really need the commandment against murder. But instructions on how to treat your children that can't be encompassed by one principle. You can't just say, be nice to your children, because that's much, much, much too general. It's very complicated. Instead, you need to thrash out details of how these things happen. So you get that over and over again. Not just here, by the way. Again, I encourage you to read, and maybe when we finish Bereishit and part of Shemot, maybe what we'll do is turn to Samuel, which is in some ways the richest character study in all of the Bible, the study of David. And when you see David with his children and his family and his wives, and you wonder again, why are they spending, so he's a king, why are they spending so much time with it? I think the same reason, because that's where we all live, right? And that's what, yeah.
She wouldn't have to go behind Jacob. She could have just say, I feel this way, and I think, I'm sorry, behind Isaac. I feel this way, and you should listen to me the same way that you have a voice. I have an equal voice. I think maybe that's...
I wonder if that's true, though. I wonder if that's true.
They had the same voice.
I'm not sure that that's true. I actually think that it's partly also the way that women and men relate to each other and work together. It's not because... and this may be societal, but in my experience, indirection is often a much more comfortable way for women to work than for men to work, right? Which is why you get thousands of discussions between men and women in which men will say some equivalent of, why don't you just tell me, right? Just say it. I don't understand what you mean when you do that, right? And I don't think, although it's very hard to know, because it's funny, I keep talking about the UCLA class because it parallels this. We just did gender and feminist theology in the last class. And one of the things that all feminist theologians point out is nature and nurture. One of the reasons why it's hard to decide what's part of nature and what's part of nurture is as the moment a child is born, And adults know if it's a male or female child, they start to treat it differently. Immediately, right? Even if you know before, right? So who knows what's nature and what's nurture? We're a long way still, I think, from figuring that out. But you said 2 points.
Now, as a parent, what I do in the society, media, everything, I look to see which families are successful and what was the evolution that led to their success. A happier family, mm-hmm. a happier parent, children. Are there any stories in the Bible where there is that dysfunction, but they did something right and things turned out to be better.
Yeah. I mean, it seems that in the end that things work out well with Joseph and his family, right? With Ephraim and Manasseh at the end of Genesis. But most of the stories of families in the Bible, you know, remember the opening of Anna Karenina? All happy families are alike, but all unhappy families are unhappy in their own way. It's hard to portray a happy family and have any dramatic tension. So most of the families in the Bible are unhappy. However, I will say that what seems to work out, which by the way, again, studies have shown in marriage, what seems to work out is when husbands listen. That is, when Isaac, even if inadvertently, does what Rebecca wants, you get a good result. When Abraham does what Sarah wants, in the end, you get a good result. So that's something you can teach your sons. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As Jacob, or maybe as Rebecca.
Yes.
That maybe our lesson is that because we're the powerless, we need to be a little bit deceptive.
Well, there's no question that that's exactly what the Zionists criticize the diaspora community for, right? For their deception, their trickery, their powerlessness, the fact that they couldn't be direct, they couldn't stand up, and the new Jew, in quotes, a Zionist Jew, was supposed to be the opposite of that, right? Because obviously they were soldiers, which was a male model of power. But if you read, for example, Power and Powerlessness in Jewish History, David Beale's book, which is a short book, he talks about the fact that Jews were much more powerful in history than people think, but they were powerful this way. That is, they were the decisive population between two different countries. And they, if they threw their influence to this ruler or that ruler, it could make a difference. So in fact, Jews weren't powerless, they were just they didn't have direct power. It's funny, I've never heard anybody say they had female power, not male power, but if you look at it historically, maybe that's what he's saying, which is it was indirect power. Yeah.
But as far as that goes, I mean, when you read our Jewish history about what you just mentioned, it was always a ransom power.
Right. Financial was part of it. That was one of the things. That was one of the things. But that wasn't, but it was more complicated than that. That wasn't always the case. That was in some instances the case. But there were other periods in which the Jewish community existed in very different conditions. But anyway, the point is that you didn't have the direct power. Okay. Let's actually get to the scene we've been talking about. Chapter 27, verse 18. He went to his father and said, Father, okay? And he said, Yes, which of my sons are you? Now, that's already a strange opening because presumably Esau and Jacob had different voices, although I don't know. I mean, I don't know how different they were, but still, it's interesting. And I have a lot of material on this whole story, but I think I'm going to save it till we read the whole story, and then we'll go back over it. Jacob said to his father, I am Esau, your firstborn. Now, the Midrash, as you may know and I may have mentioned before, divides that up. Okay? It says, Vayomer Yaakov el Aviv. Isaac said to his father, Anochi, I am. Okay? Esav bechorcha. Esav is your firstborn. Because the rabbis don't want to think that Jacob was lying. So they make it that he's telling the truth. Anochi, I am. Esav is your firstborn, right? Now, that is maybe mildly deceptive. But he says, I have done as you told me. Now, if you see this as he's telling the truth, then it's not clear what he's done that Isaac told him, unless he's really doing what Isaac wants. Anyway... So he says, pray, sit up, eat of my game, so you can give me your innermost blessing. right? Which in Hebrew is the blessing of your soul. The blessing of your soul, okay? And Isaac said to his son, how did you succeed so quickly, my son? Which, by the way, reinforces that Rebecca, of course, knew what she was doing. In other words, we were wondering, did she have time? So obviously, it takes a while to go out and shoot game and bring it back because she did it quickly enough that Isaac was surprised. And he said, because the Lord your God granted me good fortune. Right? And again, there's lots of different kinds of good fortune. Right. I don't think it's implying that it's not his God.
Never talked to God or mentioned God.
Yeah, but I don't think it's necessarily implying that it's not his God. I think that it is rather, I think that's a sort of act of respect or obeisance. Your God, of whom you have told me, or whatever. I mean, you could say that it's implying that, but I don't get it. That's not the hit I get off of it, that he's saying to him, not my God.
Later, when he finally, for the first time,
right.
Right. On this journey,
yes.
Then you
right.
Be my God.
Right. But that does yes. That's all true. But that's just consistent with Jacob's personality. That doesn't mean, though, that he's trying to say to Isaac, "It's not my God." I don't know. I really, really want to get through this scene. Okay. Please hold your comments till we do. Okay. Thank you. Isaac said to Jacob, "Come closer that I may feel you, my son." Okay, why feel you? Why does he need to do that? Is it because of the blessing, or is it because he doesn't know that it's, I mean, is this an element of doubt in his mind? Whether you are really my son Esau or not. So Jacob drew close to his father Isaac, who felt him and wondered, right? It says, because he then says, in a very famous phrase, the voice is the voice of Jacob, yet the hands are the hands of Esau. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's so, then why, when Jacob first says, "Hi, Father," does he say, "Which of my sons are you?" Why didn't he say, "Hi, Jacob"?
But he doesn't know.
But that's why doesn't he know? Because if he recognizes the voice, why does he ask? It's one more ambiguity in the story, okay? It says, he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like those of his brother Esau, and so he blessed him. Now, the voice is the voice of Jacob, yet the hands are the hands of Esau has been used many times in Jewish history. For people speak nicely, but I mean, people used to use this, for example, with reference to Arafat, about whom I will tell you a story in a second, right? His voice is the voice of Jacob, but his hands are the hands of Esau. Let me actually just tell you the story about Arafat, then we'll take questions and we'll wrap it up. At least we got to that part of the scene. But I was at a dinner where the guy who's the head of Davos was, Davos being the World Economic Forum, right? And they're the ones who arranged the meeting at Taba with Clinton and Arafat. And Peres was supposed to speak at Taba, and Arafat was supposed to speak, and then Peres was going to go after him. So this guy, whose name escapes me for the moment, who's the head of the World Economic Forum and has, you know, arranged for like gazillions of leaders to speak about everything over years and done all sorts of agreements, and he looks and sounds like a very polished diplomat. So I didn't expect him to say anything, you know, that would condemn anybody involved, because diplomats aren't supposed to. But he told the following story. He said, Arafat came to him like 15 minutes before his speech and said, "I left my speech in my room. Is there any way that Peres could go first? I'll send someone to get my speech. He'll bring the speech." So this guy went to Peres, and Peres said, "Of course, I'm perfectly happy to go first. Let him go get the speech." So in fact, Peres went first, gave a very conciliatory speech, and then Arafat, without receiving any paper from his room, got up and gave, he said, the harshest speech I've ever heard at any diplomatic conference. And it was clear to me that he set him up, he said. And I went over to Peres afterwards. He said, because I felt terrible about all of this. And Peres said, "Well, it just shows I came here for a marriage and he planned a divorce." But I just thought that there was a good example of, you know, the voice being the voice of Jacob and the hands of Esau. Okay, so now that at least we got to that, and the second part is going to be the blessing, let's take comments, questions about now. Go ahead.
Yeah.
a gentleman said made me go back a couple of weeks ago when we were, when my comment was that Esau was already an independent, autonomous, healthy person. So maybe this was all planned for Jacob to become someone, like the whole journey was character building for him. He was put into this position, like maybe he didn't even believe in God, and he had to go through this to
right. Well,
God and himself.
He does. I mean, I would say what Jules said is certainly true, that Jacob shows the greatest arc of growth in the, maybe in the Bible, apart from perhaps David. So you'll see as we trace Jacob's story, he starts off stealing. He then, as you said, he has this dream of the ladder where he says, there's God here and I didn't even know it. Then he bargains with God and says, if God takes care of me, I'll be okay. Then he goes and he tricks and gets tricked and marries two women. And then he has this great struggle with, right, where he has a struggle with the angel before he crosses the river and kisses Esau. So yes, there's a tremendous arc to Jacob's story, but whether he starts out not believing at all and aggressively saying to Isaac, this is your God, but is not my God, depends on how negative a view you want to take of Jacob at this point. And you could take a very negative view. But one of the things, I don't know if you remember this, but one of the things that I think it's Eric Auerbach points out that we talked about with the Akedah is in classical, most classical, like with Homer, heroes don't change. Achilles at the beginning of the Iliad is Achilles at the end of the Iliad. He's had experiences, but he doesn't grow the same way that biblical characters do. Moses grows and changes. Jacob grows and changes. Abraham, it seems, grows and changes, although Abraham's a more, it's less clear. So that's true. Whether Rebecca grows and changes is an interesting question too. But anyway, yeah. David Biale, B-I-A-L-E. B-I-A-L-E, I think it is.
Second,
he's a professor at UC Davis.
Thank you. Second, can you contemplate if Rebecca was a passive wife and didn't listen to God, didn't follow and didn't act upon what God told her at the beginning, what would have happened?
Well, my guess would be that God would have found another means of succeeding, but I don't know how. Right. Yeah, I think so. Would have found another way of people's doing this. By the way, I just want to say, in terms of David Biale's book, I asked Ruth Wise about it when she was here. She thinks that he overestimates how much power Jews had in the diaspora. But this is an interesting debate. His teacher, who was a wonderful man, David Biale's teacher, Amos Funkenstein, first made this argument that Jews had more power in the diaspora than people gave him credit for. And Ruth Wise thinks that Funkenstein, the teacher, was right, but that Biale carries it too far. But you can judge for yourself, obviously. Yeah. Right.
That it's translated as, which of my sons are you?
Well, they're two separate. This is what it says here. He says, mi ata b'ni. So, who are you, my son, is the literal translation. And so they are assuming when you say, who are you, my son, it must mean which son. Right? That's possible too. That's possible too. Or it just occurred to me that you could translate it as, who are you, my son? That is, not are you Jacob, but show me your real character right now, my son. Right. Which is a very nice, I like that midrash. It's a nice midrash. And the question then is, what character does Jacob show him? I don't know. Yeah.
He's deceptive. He is dual. He's of a dual nature.
and this duality is continuing on in his marriage. He marries two women. He has the wrestling with the God. His name is changing. This duality.
Mm-hmm.
And the voice, part of him is more evolved, and part of him is not. And it seems like Isaac also is caught in that
dilemma,
because he isn't able to see the truth of his son. There's a duality present throughout this whole. This duality of the evolution of a truly noble human being, a truly spiritual being, versus the midway point where you're half noble and half that's what it's called.
Right. It does work very nicely with Jacob marrying two wives and then struggling with himself as though there are two sides of him.
So accepting this duality, mm-hmm. because even he states the voice is Jacob, but the hands are.
And the brother theme, the twin theme, reinforces that, obviously, right? Which is, yes. Yeah.
You had said about the other patriarchs, how they have grown, and you look at Isaac. We know less about Isaac than any of the patriarchs.
Yeah.
He was deceived. He, first of all, he lived at home for such a long time. He was deceived by his father. He left home,
mm-hmm.
Totally traumatized, I'm sure, and his whole life was one of deception when you think about it. And Rebecca, finally brought him love and like she said, made up for what his mother wasn't able to do for him or to protect him. And I think it was his role in life is to be deceived. And and he is blind, in metaphysically, spiritually as well as physically. So I think that's, it's
yeah, I mean, I hope that it wasn't his role to be deceived, although he certainly, and in the Akedah, it's not clear if he's deceived or if he's self-sacrificing, right? Because Abraham does tell him that we're going up there and does obviously tie him to the altar. So at a certain point, he was aware of what was going on.
But didn't he think that he was going to sacrifice the goat?
At first, but then it became clear. But then,
I love that idea, and I think that the story that we just read is sort of a mirror of what we don't see happening. In other words, it shows you how Isaac handles all of this. Oh, so we're going to sacrifice a goat, but there's no goat.
Right.
And
you think... So how does he handle it?
He's accepting of his deceptions. He's complicit. He allows.
Right. He allows himself to be deceived, knowing that he's deceived, because it's easier than confronting what is in fact going on in front of him. That's a nice idea. That's a nice, I was going to say, either that he trusts God or he thinks that these people who are deceiving me must be doing it for a good reason.
It feels like in this story that we just read that we're really getting insight.
Right. As to what happened to the Akedah. And you know how the rabbis express that, right? The rabbis say that when Abraham took Isaac up to the mountain to sacrifice him, that the angels wept and their tears fell into Isaac's eyes and he went blind. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Right.
Or else realizes that Jacob does indeed deserve the blessing.
Yeah, the only thing that I would say is that the story is infinitely richer for not telling us, mm-hmm. right? Because, we started off the class wondering whether Isaac knew, and we still don't know whether he knew. And look at the range that we've come to. It can be Isaac didn't know. Isaac knew... On a sort of level, he sort of knew he was being deceived, but didn't want to look at it. Or Isaac was completely deceived and was a scapegoat. Or Isaac knew and was completely complicit and just didn't want... Because the other possibility is that he didn't want to face Esau and say, I knew, but I blessed him because he really deserves the blessing and you don't. So instead he could say to Esav, I thought it was you. Mm-hmm. I never would have done it had I known, but I thought it was you. All right, Rob, last. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I was thinking again, this story again shows the superiority of an agricultural, pastoral way of life over hunting and gathering.
Right.
But thinking a little deeper, I think it's showing more than that. It's not just an economic advantage. I think it's really showing what kind of leaders the Jewish people want. All our leaders were shepherds. And I think it's a much different relationship to food and to life. If you're caring for an animal and then at some point realize you have to sacrifice it in order to live, mm-hmm. than if you're just going out and hunting and taking a life.
The rabbis say that when God wants to pick a leader, he looks to see how they tend sheep. Which is the and part of that is that one of the ways you judge someone's character is how they treat people they don't need, right? That is, you can treat sheep lots of different ways and still be a shepherd. But when and they say that, by the way, after that story of Moses, why did God pick Moses? I don't know if you know this midrash, a very nice midrash. He was tending the flocks of his father-in-law Jethro, and one of the sheep ran away. And he followed it for miles and miles, and then he saw that it was by a stream and drinking. And he said, oh, had I known that you were thirsty, I would have pastured you by a stream. When the sheep finished drinking, Moses picked it up on his shoulders and carried it back to the flock. And the rabbis say, at that moment, God looked down and said, that's my leader. And on that note, I'll see you next time.